welcome to another broadcast of Philosophic Perspectives on the Artist First Radio Network. All past broadcasts are archived and you can pick them up at artistfirst.com. And now here he is, your host, Arthur D. Schwartz.
Hello, everybody. How are you today? Nice to have you with me. Well, today, today's show is entitled The Movement for an Independent, No Parties Political System. And I'm being perfectly audacious on purpose because I feel that that's where what this country needs to have, and the world, actually. It goes beyond American politics. I believe in an independent political system. I've talked about this before. In fact, I had a show on it only a couple months back. But now, as I observe the campaign as it's been proceeding, I feel more and more that the kind of thing I'm talking about resonates with the American public. The independents are the ones that are doing the best. It seems in the campaign, or almost Hillary Clinton, of course, she's not an independent, but Sanders called himself an independent. Trump really is an independent. And it's not just that you want independence. It really goes beyond that. That could be a bad thing under certain circumstances, probably in the way the system is structured now, because it's basically a mess. So everything is dysfunctional. So I want to talk to you. I'm going to get started here by giving you my idea of a dream of how a political system can work. You know, the idea of a Trump and Sanders election, I know that's not likely. It's, you know, most people don't think Sanders is going to win, but I mean, he's doing pretty well. Let's just say he did. You know, hypothetically, that's a very scary thing. It's a scary thing because it reminds me of some of the things in some of the kind of elections in Europe where you have these radical opposites, you know, and you already see it now. They're fighting. Also, I saw someone, there was some violence at a Sanders rally. Of course, Trump's had a lot of it. It brings back all these memories and recollections of these horrible horrible things that go on in elections that, if for the most part in America, we haven't had. And you see, you can see how that can happen, because when you have political parties, right, left, and it's like a boxing match, and you get all the hatred, and you'll get the stuff, you know, all get all worked up. But the thing of it is that the parties exacerbate the problem, because parties take an ideology and create division. That's what they're all about, us against them. That's what the parties do. That's what they're all about. That's how they make their money. And it really doesn't matter too much about policy. What matters is that we win and you lose. And so this is my dream. This is my dream of how a political system should work, is that change is not forced through by one party dominating another in the election, per se. But change evolves in the legislature, where the men and women have no party affiliation. In fact, a party affiliation would be abolished, would be made illegal. The public financing would also be eliminated. Private financing would be eliminated. So a universal funding of elections would be in place. And so money would be taken out of the equation. And so you don't need parties financing the elections. And the special interests can't be bending the elections and skewing the elections and corrupting the elections. And you have a legislature of men and women, and you have issues that come up, legislative acts come up all the time, and coalitions will evolve gradually and then disassemble and reassemble, and the process of governance, the process of innovation, the process of legislation would be a natural process with disparate individuals coming together and going their own way. And that's the way of nature, without parties dividing these huge blocks, us against them. I mean, how many times you see where, I mean, right now it's the Republican Party. It seems to be worse. I mean, in terms of how they're just voting, they form this block and they just basically sabotage legislation. But I don't even want to, point at the Republicans. Parties do this in general. And how many times do we see, like, well, you have almost all the Democrats voting together. You have almost all the Republicans voting together. And that's not normal. If those individuals, if we just strip their parties and we just pretend for a moment that there are no Republicans and no Democrats and each one of these individuals were elected, I mean, of course, they wouldn't have been elected, actually, if under the system that I'm talking about, but just for the sake of discussion, you would not have those artificial blocks, clearly, because they're being held together, the whips and so forth. The parliamentary system, our system is a non-parliamentary system, which is organized like a parliamentary system, really. Because in a parliamentary system, it really is a party government. I mean, that's the way it works. The parties have to, get a majority in parliament and they vote in the prime minister. Here, it's very, very different. We have a direct election of the president. And then we elect legislators, representatives and senators. And the way the system was set up, it's not a party government. You don't need to get majorities. The president does not need to have a majority to stay in office, for example. And so what you would have without parties is, which is, I believe, the way this, the Constitution or people like George Washington Madison conceived of it, of the system, is, I like to remind people, that was George Washington's farewell address. He warned against the formation of political parties. He was right. He was right. How many? 250 years ago. He was so right. And so the thing is, you would not have, it would be almost impossible because, you see, because right now every member of Congress knows he's a Republican or a Democrat, maybe handing a few independents in there. And so they know what the party line is. They know what the party, whip won, what the party wants to, what they want from their members. Now, I mean, it's not 100% unanimity, but it's close to it. It really is pretty close to the unanimous. If there was no party, if there were no parties, you would have something amazing happen. You would have intelligent men and women figuring out policies, legislation, and so forth. And change will emerge. Look at the thing when Obama, this is during the last election, and in terms of the Obamacare, and I'm trying to remember, it was in the last election, I think, where all the backlash was occurring. What's that guy's name, the plumber or whatever? I'm trying to remember if that was the 08 election or the 12 election. But there was such an outrage about the possibility of the Affordable Care Act getting through. And it was just, and it still is, some people are just so against it, so horrible to them. But here is the thing. This is all being whipped up by parties. Without parties, there would or would not be a system. There would or would not be a system. It would evolve by a consensus of the legislature, each member of which has been elected by the people. And it would rise or fall based upon that natural consensus that is not being corrupted, that is not being distorted by party politics. So, I mean, I am for national universal health care, of course. I mean, I am personally, but that's not the point. Whether it goes or whether it does not go can emerge almost like a flourishing of harmonic aspects of the society that come together and find those areas where consensus is derived and policy is formed. This is something so possible. And so this Trump-Sanders, a potential Trump-Sanders election, which once again is unlikely, but it scares me because it reminds me of, like in Germany, the Nazis and the communists and all that, and all these confrontational situations that they all, what was the common denominator? It's all about parties. See, when parties can whip up people, whip up the electorate, and then they form blocks, and it's easy to know who your enemy is, so-called. Now, of course, the issues aren't going to go away. It's just that you won't look at people as your enemy, politically speaking. Sure, some people might be, much more conservative than others, but there'll be far more ability to work together. People forget what a good relationship Ronald Reagan had with Tip O'Neill, actually. Tip O'Neill, a very liberal Democrat, Speaker of the House for many, many years. And Reagan, obviously extremely conservative Republican. And they had a good relationship. The situation has gotten worse, much worse, in these intervening 30 years or so. And so... this is something I believe, and what I would like to see is, because I'm not just saying it because I have a proposal for it. I'm saying because I can go out there and look what's happening, that how many people now are consider themselves independents. I'm not sure if there are more independents now than, I think there are more independents than Republicans. I'm not sure if there are more independents than Democrats. People think of themselves as independents. People are disgusted with the political parties and their dysfunctionality. People don't see any point of it. This is a change that is relatively new. The growth of independent identity in America is really growing. I've been into this for a long time. I actually wrote a paper in my freshman year at American University on this very subject. And it's faded, and it's old, and it's dated December 7th, 1970. And my opinion hasn't changed too much. I mean, evolved it a little bit. I cover this in my current book, Ethical Empowerment, on section 2.19, where I call the eclipsing the political party, 2.19. And then on 2.44, Beyond Disunity, is where I look at the political party, the nation state, and religion as being, I call it, the triadic disunity. And there are other disunities I go into, but that seems to be the big triad that seems to be causing so much mischief. And those three things together, but right now I'm focusing on the political party and what a system would be like without, in the United States, a Democrat and Republican party. I'm also, I'm talking in terms of an American context, but actually I believe world for democracies around the world. I think the parliamentary system, obviously, since it is actually a party system, that is structured as a party system. Our parties are sort of like... sort of informal in the sense that it's not part of the governmental structure per se, whereas a parliamentary system is based upon parties. And so there you are having the same kind of problem, and every country has to, make their way. The thing about our system is it is a kind of an adulteration of a system that was designed, in my view, to be an independent political system. But they borrowed a lot of these parliamentary procedures and they've overlaid a kind of parliamentarianism, I should say, into ours, and I don't think it works. That's a big cause of the problem. And so I believe that this is going to happen. I'm not saying it's going to happen now, but if anyone is out there and is hearing me and agrees with me, let me know at radio@arthurdschwartz.com, and we'll start something right now. Because when I say political parties really suck, it's because a lot of people know they really suck. They're really bad, and they don't really serve any purpose whatsoever except get people elected over and over and over again. Now, the system that I'm talking about here would have the political parties banned outright. Now, this one of the things in the indicate that we are moving into an era of independent politics is something called the nonpartisan primary system. I think California and several other states have that now. And we have it in many cities, in Boston and many other cities as well. Their mayors are elected in that way, in terms of that the primary the party position is irrelevant. It's the top two winners that run off. And that's kind of what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a series of qualifying elections. So on the presidential level, you would have qualifying elections that gradually would winnow out until someone, until you have someone, you have to win 50%. Now, of course, there's constitutional issues here. I mean, that would have to be worked out, or maybe not. It could probably, be able to be bypassed. You can have, you can just say the very last two would have to go through the formal election. So in that case, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I think that that possibly would work because that's what we have right now. You'd have the issue of having independents, other independents who might want to run. And so that probably might need a constitutional amendment, most likely. But the idea is, with what I'm talking about, would be anybody and everybody who gets enough signatures can get on the ballot just like they can now. But they're not party. These aren't primaries. They are general elections. And I'm not just talking about the president. I think every election should be that way, going down to, city clerk. I mean, every election should be run this way. In a presidential context, there would have to be quite a few, elections, qualifying elections. And it would winnow out. And then at the last election, we'd have two to run off. I mean, I would like to say, well, if you get 50% or more, you win. I think there's constitutional issues there. There are probably constitutional issues because after that process, then you'd ask, what if someone wants to run as an independent? Well, with the system I'm describing, everyone's an independent. Everyone has a chance to run. So that wouldn't really be necessary. So that probably would require a constitutional amendment. But anyway, I'm really speaking, this is a show about called Philosophic Perspective, so it's about, ideas. But every law and every process, first has to have an idea. And so, and to a certain degree, I'm quite certain that I believe this will work, and I think the country is getting ready for it. We have this whole thing with, in the Democratic Party, superdelegates. So, like, Hillary Clinton has a lot of superdelegates. By the way, she also has most of the votes, so that's a little bit of a bogus argument on the Sanders side, because Hillary Clinton is clearly ahead in the popular vote. But the superdelegates are put in there to kind of stabilize the election for the Democrats, so you don't have these, make it a little bit more, the party can have more control over the nominee. Well, the thing is, in the process that I'm talking about, you really wouldn't even need that, because you see, each election is a general election. Each election allows everyone who is qualified based upon the winnowing out, getting the signatures and winnowing out the the qualified candidates to move on, the system would just work out all by itself. And most likely, looking at the it's interesting to look at the current election and see how it might have worked out if such a process was in place. And it'd be really interesting. I tend to think it would be neither Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. I really think it would involve candidates who are more broadly supported across the board. Because don't forget, Trump was running in the Republican primaries. Clinton is running in the Democratic primaries. Each of them, in their own ways, capitalized on a minority group that was enough to create, a victory within their respective primary system. But in the system I'm talking about, every election would be a general election, would involve all of the candidates. And so Hillary Clinton would be competing against Kasich. And Donald Trump would be competing against Sanders, and so forth and so on. And also, it would be easier for other people to get into the campaign, and it would just work out. It would be a natural evolution without this phoniness that goes on in this kangaroo court that we had in these primaries. And so that's what I'm fighting for, and let's just call it an independent or movement for an independent, no parties political system. And it would, the idea really starts with George Washington, or actually James Madison, actually I think came up with it before in the Federalist Papers. He wrote something. And so at this particular point in time, I'm going to get my thoughts together, I'm going to move forward, and I'm going to take a break, and I will be back shortly.
In Ethical Empowerment, Virtue Beyond the Paradigms, Arthur D. Schwartz presents an ethical theory that is a framework for evaluating moral conundrums that go beyond legalistic rulemaking, dogmatism, and preconditioned thinking. The book is as much an ethical framework for unconventional ideas as it is for staying with convention. Ethical Empowerment is a manifesto of non-doctrinaire perspective. Ultimately, the hypnotic thinking of ideology and dogmatism can only be overcome by returning to the true source and essence of morality, which is nothing less than universal love. Discover how the philosophically liberating approach of the ethical empowerment can be applied to the range of ethical, social, and political controversy. Read about a plan to eliminate all political parties. Entertain the possibility of an overhaul of the patent system and its replacement with a system that rewards inventors while eliminating monopolistic control of patents and technological suppression. Many other transformative ideas are discussed in the book, including issues related to the monetary system, real estate, scientific paradigms, and a rational approach to conspiracy theory. While Ethical Empowerment will challenge your mind to consider new perspectives, the ethical challenge is always to keep the diversity, depth, and breadth of perspective within the boundaries of love. Ethical Empowerment is available at Amazon.com and most online booksellers in both print and ebook editions. You are listening to Philosophic Perspectives on the Artist First Radio Network. Past shows are archived. You can pick them up at artistfirst.com. Now back to your host, Arthur D. Schwartz.
Welcome back. Thank you very much. Now, so What I'd like to do now is, well, before I just get to what I'm about to say, I just want to go over what I'm talking about. I am now declaring that there should be a movement for an independent, no-parties political system. Let it start now. And it basically involves the abolition of the political party. Now, what by political party, it doesn't mean there's always going to be a group, an organization that's going to endorse a candidate. I mean, that's fine. But the organization is not going to be able to finance a candidate because I've got to that point, but I, like many people, advocate a universal campaign financing, which would basically eliminate private money. So everyone would have the same, same budget basically to run on, and obviously it would get bigger, you know, as you move along. So I just lost my train of thought here for a second. But in this system, there will be no parties, no political parties. Without the money, there'll be no. You can have special interest groups. You can have lobbying groups. That's fine. You need that in legislation. But they just wouldn't have the money to campaign to get to the to the candidates. Because you know what, ladies and gentlemen, if you're a special interest group and you're giving money to a campaign, let's just call a spade for what it is. Let's call a spade a spade. It's bribery. That's all it is. It's bribery. So it's legalized bribery. So I'm looking for a system of independent parties, no party affiliation on the ballot. The legislature would not be, the whole thing would have to be, you know, changed because there's no parties that are organizing the conduct of the Congress or the parliamentary organ that happens to be that we're talking about. What would happen is there would be caucuses, of course, around special issues. There is a way back when I came up with, you know, started studying this back in, you know, I told you back in 1971 as a freshman, I discovered that the political scientist who came up with an idea that was somewhat similar to this, well, he was in favor of abolishing the institutionalized political party. His name was, Monsieur Ostrogarsky. His book was called Democracy and the Organization of Political Parties. That's the book that got me on this track. I might do some differences with what I'm saying, but basically, I think he's the one that came up with the essential idea that parties are destructive, they are insidious, they are confrontational, and certainly in our day and age, it might have been a place for it in the past, you know, I would acknowledge that, but today, no longer. So anyway, I'd like to invite Scott, the engineer, the extraordinaire, and I guess he has a lot of huddles over there. to come in and you can, Scott, why don't you fire away, because I think you might have some questions for me.
Well, first of all, I love the topic and I love the concept. I just don't know how it would be implemented. For instance, please enlighten me because I'm behind this idea 100%. As a proud independent, I'm proud to not be a Republican. I'm proud to not be a Democrat. They hold nothing over me. First of all, if I understand the Constitution correctly, the Electoral College was set up to prevent majority rule. They didn't want the states with the larger populations winning every election, and I think there was some merit to that. But then we look up and say, well, gee, Al Gore got more votes than George W. Bush, but he didn't get the presidency. It seems unfair. So how do you resolve that question that the big states, just New York and California, will get what they want every time, and the states like Rhode Island and Alaska will never get what they want?
Well, actually, yeah. This is the Electoral College is a different issue. I know a lot of it's very popular to you want to say direct election of the president. I actually am a fan of the Electoral College. I know that sounds strange, but no, I am. And actually, what you said is not correct, Scott. I mean, many times New York's on the losing side, or California's on the losing side. The reason they or the winning side. The reason they did that is much for the same reason that, for example, Rhode Island has two senators, and New York has two senators, or Alaska has two senators, and California has two senators too, because what they were doing in the Constitution was about, it's a system of checks and balances. Now, of course, in the case of the House of Representatives, it's purely representational. So California or New York and Texas and so forth have a whole bunch of representatives, and I think Vermont has one. I think Bernie Sanders at one time was a congressman before Senate. I think Vermont has one representative only. So the reason they did that is because there's a balance between the popular, between popular vote, but also, independent states. And so, little states like Montana, need to have feeling that they're just not going to be, that they mean something. Or otherwise, they would be completely, they wouldn't even matter. And there is a lot of, you can just say, well, one man, one vote. But that sounds nice. But it's also important for interests, farming interests and other interests around the country in smaller states. That need to, I think what the Electoral College does is it makes candidates, it forces them to take Montana and Rhode Island and little states like that and take them seriously. So the Electoral College was created on the same basis of why all the states have two senators. It's because they need to make sure that the country is being run fairly. At the same token, they're not equal to California. California has all these representatives, so we have the big states have a huge advantage in the House of Representatives if you look at it that way. So, but anyway, that's just my explanation. But that's a little bit off track because that has no bearing specifically with what I'm talking about. Yes, it does have a constitutional bearing. I actually mentioned that. So I realize what I'm proposing would probably have some constitutional ramifications. Some could be avoided. I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but the way it seems to me, it probably would work right up until the very final election. So I'm talking about having these winnowing elections, these winnowing general elections, okay? They wouldn't be regional. They wouldn't be New England. They wouldn't be by one state. The whole country would have winnowing elections for president of the United States. I mean, I don't know how many. It would probably be something like 8 or something like that. It would be quite a few, maybe more, I don't know, quite a few elections. Like we have now primaries, but these will be national primaries. But we really would, I would describe them as qualifying general elections. And I think the Constitution wouldn't be involved at all up until the very, very end. So because the Constitution aside, you could say, well, if the second to the last election, you get one candidate gets 50% or more, he should be president. And I would say, yes, that's the way they do in mayoral elections, like in Boston and in many cities, since that's a result of the progressive era, one of the progressive era. Reforms that occurred in many cities have these, they have the way they elect their mayors. It's just everyone runs and then the top two run off. And that's kind of the system that I'm talking about. However, because we do have an electoral college, so the final runoff doesn't really make a whole hill of beans. Unless you're actually counting electoral votes. I mean, I really think you probably would have a problem at that point because at the very least, how would you legislate that other candidates who want to run as independents, even though everyone is an independent in the system, would come in after the final election? So I see probably a constitutional issue there that would have to be resolved. But once again, this is more philosophical. I mean, the beautiful thing about philosophy is we can be very impractical, and we come up with ideas, and then if it flies, then the legislators and the lawyers have to figure out how it's going to all work. You have to make some changes. So there might be some constitutional changes, or maybe not. Because you see, you could run these elections when each election is looking at it from an electoral standpoint. So every election, in terms of the popular vote, you could ultimately say, well, the top finishers are, and then you rank them in terms of electorally. That's okay with me. And it would work out that way, too. So that might possibly get by it. I mean, I'm sure there are constitutional issues, but maybe not. I'm not nearly knowledgeable enough to say. But I'm not one of those who is, an opponent of the electoral system. I think it's actually genius. You know, I'll tell you something. Gore did not lose because of the Electoral College, really. Well, yes and no. Yes, the way it turned out, he got less electoral votes than did Bush. However, don't forget what happened. I mean, there was all kinds of voting irregularities, and that's what cost an election. I'll tell you another thing that cost Gore the election, his obstinacy, or perhaps arrogance, because he didn't allow Bill Clinton to help him in the campaign. And all he needed was about 10 more votes in Arkansas, for example, Clinton's home state, and he would have won. So there's a lot of reasons why Gore didn't win and should have won. But still, let's just say those irregularities did not exist, and Bush still won. Well, I'm okay with that because I actually do see the advantages of the electoral system. It's very, very, very rare when the winner of the Electoral College is not the winner of the electoral of the popular vote. What happened in that election hadn't happened for well over 100 years. I forget when it was. It was very, 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 very rare. And so, and again, once you look, when you, and if you look at it too, also the system that I'm talking about, I think would get away with a lot of the corruption would disappear, because you see, what I'm advocating is the abolition of the political parties. And if you abolish the political parties, I think you by that one fell swoop, you abolish a lot of the corruption. I don't know. How did I answer your question?
I think you answered it well. But how would you differentiate between a political party and, say, somebody like the NRA or AARP or NAACP? Now, you might say, well, gee, they're not political parties now. Well, of course not. But they're special interest groups. And if you ban political parties, don't special interest groups become de facto political parties?
Right. Yeah, no, so I addressed that. So, yes, you cannot abolish interest groups. And interest groups are good. You know, regardless of your view on gun control, I mean, I believe the NRA has a right to exist. They have a right to recommend candidates and to lobby. But if you're listening or if you were following, in concomitance with the program I proposed for an independent political system, there would be no more public campaign financing. There would be it would be publicly financed elections, no private campaign funding. So when there's no private campaign funding, the NRA and other lobby groups, how would they influence the members of the legislature or the president? Well, like anybody else. Simply because I'm the NRA, I have all these members who believe this, and we're not going to vote for you if you don't go along with us. I mean, they're entitled to do that. What they would not be entitled to do is give them tons of money. So we don't want to. As a matter of fact, interest groups are a good thing. There's nothing wrong with interest groups. There's nothing wrong with a lobby group if all they do is go to Mr. Senator. My organization wants you to support this. This legislation because our members are needed very badly, and it's the right thing to do. So there's nothing wrong with that. If you're a congressman, you need to have lobbyists come to you to present the various issues, because that's what makes the world go around. They need to know the different points of view. The thing is, they will not have money. just like the political parties won't have money. Political parties, of course, one of the main things that makes them tick is because they raise money and they give the money to their candidates. That will all be gone.
But wait, okay, so the NRA, I'm a gun owner. I don't have anything against the NRA whatsoever, but let's use them as an example. So one thing it seems to me, for good or for bad, that political parties do is consolidate a bunch of points of view of different things. And so if the political parties were no longer able to fund national television campaigns, but the NRA was and AARP was and all these, then we'd have multi-million dollar expenditures by special interest groups to get their point across. I would think there'd be a lot more political ads. Not that I care. I'm just saying, you see where that's going?
Well, having the NRA or any organization, you're saying they would, okay, what I said does not preclude them from running ads on TV saying, you know, we're the NRA and we believe in the Second Amendment, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And same thing with, you know, the fruit growers or agricultural interests or industrial issues or whomever, okay? So whatever, or for the elderly, you know, so they can run commercials. That's okay. What they can't do is donate. Yeah, so that's okay. I mean, I don't think we can get rid of that. But they cannot give money to candidates. You understand? So the NRA can be running commercials recommending their, expressing their views on legislation, but they're not, what they cannot do is give money to candidates for president, senator, congress, or anybody, or any elected office.
Right. So therefore, they would have, right now, their candidates, their boys or their girls, carry their point of view to the public for them. They support the candidate. The candidate supports them.
I'm not saying
this is good or bad. I'm just making an observation that if you're the NRA or any of these other groups out there, you can't just give money to one or the other political parties and have them stand in for you. You're going to have to get out there and do it yourself.
Right. Right. So I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with various organizations, you know. Running commercials and advertising for what they believe in. I mean, I don't really see a problem with that. What I see a problem is having people running for office getting money from these people, and when they get into office, have the lobbying groups have the ability to tell them, you know, to, you know, wink, wink, you know, if you vote for this, we'll give you a big donation, which happens all the time. That's what you can't do. I don't think we can, nor would we want to deprive special interest groups their ability to promote their cause.
Right. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying I'm making an observation that it would be a boom for the networks, because instead of having two or three parties buying as much airtime as they could, you would have 200 or 300 special interest groups buying as much time as they could. Nothing wrong with that.
I'm not so sure if it would work that way, because you see, once you get rid of the political parties, and that special interest groups can only advertise just on issues that they believe in. So, you see, when they're spending this advertising money, they can't run an advertising and say, you know, please vote for, you know, Mr. X. They can't do that. And so, without that, I think their payback is going to be a little bit more, not as clear, because sure, they're influencing public opinion, they're not. There's no direct link to a candidate. Now, sure, you could say, well, they know that if you run in Milwaukee, and if you're running this ad for, you know, a pro gun control, and Mr. Jones is running, he's the pro candidate there, so therefore it would go in his help in his behalf. Well, sure. I think that's the way it should be. I have really no problem with that. My problem is that I don't believe it's good that our elected officials are basically accepting bribes every single day, which is what a campaign donation from a special interest group is.
I agree. Well, and your point about having the runoffs, you know, anybody who could meet a signature criteria, crossbar that you could put out there, get a minimum number of signatures, you can get on the ballot. So one might imagine that in a state like California, you might have 1,000 people running for governor, 1,000 people running for senators. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I think in the modern age, as a couple of our states have shown this past election cycle, they're going to internet voting. So if people could simply go home and vote, you could have an election every week. The point I was getting to, if you had 1,000 candidates, maybe you'd have to meet a threshold of 1% of the vote to move on to the next round. And then after round two, you'd have to meet a minimum threshold of 5% of the vote. Until, like you said, you whittle it down to till you got somebody who can win 50.1%, or the elections keep on going.
Well, I don't think it's really different than what it is today, really.
It's around the world. Sorry for interrupting you, but around the world they do this all the time. This is commonplace in many countries around the world.
Right.
And it works there.
To collecting signatures?
No, to have many, many candidates run. And then they whittle it down. Okay, the first round we had all these people,
right.
And now we're down to 15, now we're down to 3, and now we have a winner. That's very common in many countries. So,
that's fine. But also, the thing is, I think you're going to, while we have in this country to get on the ballot, you have to get a certain number of signatures. So I don't think it would be too much different. The thing is, for example, in a national election, I'll say a presidential election, I would say it would be different because you're saying, well, in the first round, in order to get onto the ballot, and actually basically it's only getting on the first ballot, because once you're on. So you have to have this minimum, and it probably you wouldn't have to get in every state. It's a national election, so therefore, whatever that threshold is, so that, in other words, if you're somebody living down in Alabama and you can't afford to collect signatures in Massachusetts or New York, it's not going to be held against you. Once you get a certain number of signatures, you get on. And so that's pretty much what they do now, I believe. So, if there are more on the ballot, I agree with you, too. That's okay. In the beginning, you'll have a whole bunch of names, obviously. It's pretty extraordinary if you're a complete unknown and you don't get elected. So obviously established leaders and elected officials and so forth, they're going to have a big advantage. Well, that's the way it kind of should be, right? We should know who we're voting for. But if somebody, an unknown, does a really good job and they get enough signatures, they'll be in the ballot. That'll happen as well. It's happening. I don't really see too much of a difference in that score than it is now. But the problem now is that in terms of collecting signatures, is that some states have very unfair rules about
I have an idea about that. What about this thought? If we can perfect securely voting with the internet, like your phone number, it belongs to you for the rest of your life. So you get a phone number that's going to go with you forever. That becomes your vote. So some people say, well, gee, we'd have to have lots more elections. For God's sakes, people, do you know the amount of money this country spends on elections? Just on the political cycle, billions and billions of dollars go into these campaigns. Couldn't we redirect that money to have a more efficient electoral system that you get to vote and that number, just like your Social Security number, goes with you from birth to death? This number, maybe you use your Social Security number, I don't know, as your voting ID. We should be able to figure out a way that, okay, maybe there's election every 2 days. Go home and vote. Vote on your cell phone, no matter where you are. I think the technology could catch up to the need. And I think for the money we whiz away on these elections, we could put it to better use with more secure electoral processes like what I'm describing. I think it's an interesting thought to ponder.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, I'm not sure I completely followed you though, Scott, because you're talking about everyone can vote easily if you just by social security number. Well, you remember my statement about please don't vote. So I'm not right.
Yeah, you're also supporting Donald Trump.
I actually don't have a problem for people that be required to make the effort to go to the polling place, because and of course I have a problem people voting because they feel they need to vote and they're not even paying attention. So I don't think that does the democratic process any service. I'm not saying they shouldn't be made not allowed to vote. But I'm simply saying, but me, I mean, when it's election and I haven't paid any attention to it, I freely choose not to vote because I just don't want to spread my ignorance around. But this is like a little different subject. The thing is, you're talking about with your social security number making it easy to vote.
Well, or a signature, or gather signatures. The same thing. Instead of, like you say, how can a guy in Alabama get signatures in Massachusetts? Right. The exact same way. That number allows you to sign different. You can only sign up for one dog catcher. You can only sign up for one senator, et cetera. We could use that technology to allow that poor farmer down there to have the same access to people that the rich guys do.
Yeah, well, yeah, if it's worked out so it's not abused, I have no problem. I mean, if you have a system where the whole country can be voicing, I mean, I you know what the thing about the internet is, honestly, I have some personal experience with groups I run. The internet makes things too easy. Like, for example, My big complaint with some of my groups is people at RSVP and that they're going to come and then they don't show up, you know, the no-show. And the no-shows are a big problem in this country. I mean, not only in groups, but doctor's offices and all kinds of things, no-shows. And people can just blow you up. But the thing is, when it's on the internet and it's got you so easy to click, I'm going to come. So easy to click. And then they just they think because they're so easy to click, they can just blow me off and forget about it, it doesn't matter, and screw you. And so, I mean, that is the new internet age, and in this respect, that's not a good thing because, for example, I personally, when I have people coming to a restaurant, I make reservations and so forth, and then people don't show up because they didn't have the energy to click that they can't come to let me know. The point I'm trying to make is, when you translate that into registering your support for a candidate, it's just a little too simple. I know, at least in Massachusetts, when candidates are running, I go to a shopping center and they're out there with these forms and people talk to them and they tell you about this candidate and why and they give you a little talk. I mean, and sometimes I'll sign and sometimes they won't sign. I just think it makes it a little bit more of an effort, and I think that elections are important business, and so I don't think we should make it too easy. So, but that's just my point.
But how do you get that? Your example of the farmer in Arkansas, and he has a national issue. Just the sheer fact that requiring, even at a statewide issue, I live in Ohio, I don't know how many ballots, they send out these people, you need 100,000, 200,000 signatures, they collect 400,000, and the sorry SOB corrupt attorney general throws out 395,000 and say, well, they were written on the wrong kind of paper, they're all invalid. And that very high bar to get over, just to send people out, what the hell does that cost? You know, often the people collecting these signatures are people on the margins of society who need an afternoon job or a college kid. They're not really into as much as they're into. They're getting paid by the signature in many cases. Anyway, just the sheer cost to that farmer. Well, my God, okay, you're going to need people in every county, in every state, across the country. That alone is going to cost you $30
million. Well, look. I've already said I'm in favor of abolishing all private campaign financing. In other words, I don't think a candidate, I don't think anyone, you know, I mean, maybe if you want to keep it at a minimal level, but I'm prepared to say zero. I mean, I can agree to a little something, but I really feel it should be zero, and so everyone has a fair shot. Well, so one of the things I didn't talk about is I feel that in the election process, the media should be opened up to everybody. who reaches a certain threshold. So the farmer can get onto, you know, TV stations and get onto internet. Today's technology, we actually have more of an ability to do that, to get the, you know, to let the people know about who he or she is. So if you're a nobody, you at least have a chance. Look, we have to be practical about it, right? I mean, we have to have some way of deciding who's going to get on the ballot. We can't have all, 250 million people on the ballot. So in other words, how do we do that? Well, obviously the well-known figures are not going to have a problem, but I agree the lesser known should have an ability to do that too. So I do feel opening up the media is one way with our technology today to give people a chance. But I'm not really so super concerned about that because, I've said before, if you talk about president of the United States, if you're talking about governor, even if you're talking about mayor, but let's say you're talking about governor, certainly, and senator, I would think that the people running would be people that already have a reputation, right? Well, I mean, isn't it natural if you want to be CEO of a big corporation? I mean, they're going to hire Mr. Nobody.
Most CEOs should be lined up and shot. Wait, was I talking out loud? What if you took it away? What if you took the politics away from network TV? Now, five network executives just grabbed their hearts and died as they hit the floor when they lost. But no, it's not such a crazy idea. We have public television. We have public radio. Fox right. News, the Fox propaganda network, exists to furnish the views, to promote the views of the conservative party, of the wing of the Republican Party. Now, of course, they're having to stand on their heads, and people like Sean Hannity are supporting Donald Trump. But you could create a network, just like a highway. You got a road crew. Okay, well, national. In other words, you got two or three TV channels, two or three radio channels,
yeah,
internet channels. Okay, well, what about the local? Okay, local is from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock. Then it's national, so you can allot time for your local people, and it's run by an independent thing. You could run the commercials. The payments for the commercials could help support the network and take those propaganda. I mean, my God, they take their lessons from Goering over there in Hitler, over there at Fox. People like Rush Limbaugh have made a career of being demagogues.
Right. I think you're agreeing with me. That's exactly. I mean, I didn't talk too much about that, but yeah, for my proposal to work, it depends upon. You have to need public financing or public, financing or public platforms for upstarts to get their message across. And so you're talking about all the possibilities now in creating networks for just this purpose. And it's very, very doable. And I think that if I understand you correctly and you agree with me, that's exactly what I have in mind.
24-hour a day, devoted channels to the public, national and local, funded by tax dollars and available to everyone.
Right. Because the only way a no parties electoral system would work, a no parties political system would work, would be that the parties cannot get their money to corral people like herd, so they become, either A or B, either a Democrat or a Republican generally, or you have secondary parties, Libertarians and so forth, Green Party and so forth and so on. It has to be as such that independents can just come on board and they don't have to be, owing everything to this party organization. Now, obviously, still, the people who are celebrities, office holders, they will hold a big advantage. That's the way it should be, right? I mean, it's like anything else. I mean, if you know, credentials, it just should mean something. I have no problem with that.
I don't know if whoever's the rapper of the week should be the city councilman in Chicago that month.
Well, you know what? And that's the thing. So the whole thing is, if you want to work that way, it will. It's fine with me. That's something that it just should not be controlled. You let it. You open it up to the people. Give the people an opportunity to make their cases known. And if a few unknowns, you know, catch on, and almost undoubtedly will be the case, then so be it. And so be it. But that would be a system that would completely revolutionize our society in a good way. Because what would happen would be you would have a true representative body that would be able to coalesce around the different issues, unobstructed by artificial divisions of corrupt money influence and hardwired party division. It would be a whole new world, and it will work. So, like I was saying, because I am looking at the clock, Scott, I guess we're running it down, but what I'm saying here is that I am announcing a new movement for an independent, no parties political system, and I wrote this thing on my meetup group. And I think what I'm going to do is read it, because this will be the declaration. I think that way, and then we'll finish off. Okay, Scott?
Oh, sure.
Yes, I have the audacity to announce a new political movement to abolish the political party and to create a democratic system that encourages statesmanship rather than political partisanship. A necessary analog or accompaniment of this new independent political system is the establishment of universal public funding of campaign financing. I did a radio show on this subject recently on February 17th, but as the U.S. presidential campaign has unfolded, I am more convinced than ever that my proposal or similar proposals is deeply resonant with a growing segment of the electorate. The problem is, as I see it, that the public has been brainwashed into thinking that political parties are necessary to a democracy. But this is a false notion. In fact, the political party is one of the greatest threats to democracy. The general framework for a no-party political system is an idea that I formed when I was a first semester freshman at American University in Washington, D.C. Indeed, I am looking at the faded essay now as I write this, and I talk about references in my book, Ethical Empowerment. A no-parties independent political system combined with a universal campaign financing system will allow political change to naturally emerge through the consensus of independent legislators rather than with the artificially reinforced division that is the raison d'etre of the political party, the institutionalized political party in particular. This type of emergence is, I believe, what the founding fathers believed in and clearly voiced in George Washington's farewell address. The fear and disruption that the current campaign cycle in the United States is experiencing can be directly tied to a system that has been corrupted by the dysfunctional party system and legalized bribery by special interest lobbies, as well as by massive campaign funding in general. Yes, I have a lot of audacity to call for the launching of a new political movement. Maybe so. But I don't care if I am the only one in the forest and no one hears me, except maybe for Scott. But if you are reading this, or should I say listening to this, and if you listen to this show, which I hope you have, then you and I make two, and then anything becomes possible. So I think with that, I want to thank Scott very much for joining me. I really appreciate it, Scott. Thank you very much.
It's been a fascinating lecture.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. It's always great to work with you. It really is. So this does conclude tonight's broadcast. For links to my book, Ethical Empowerment, my philosophical counseling and hypnotherapy practice, and the Social Philosophizers Club, please visit arthurdschwartz.com. And this is Arthur D. Schwartz reminding you to live well and think deeply. Until next time. Good night, everybody.
In Ethical Empowerment, Virtue Beyond the Paradigms, Arthur D. Schwartz presents an ethical theory that is a framework for evaluating moral conundrums that go beyond legalistic rulemaking, dogmatism, and preconditioned thinking. The book is as much an ethical framework for unconventional ideas as it is for staying with convention. Ethical Empowerment is a manifesto of non-doctrinaire perspective. Ultimately, the hypnotic thinking of ideology and dogmatism can only be overcome by returning to the true source and essence of morality, which is nothing less than universal love. Discover how the philosophically liberating approach of the Ethical Empowerment can be applied to the range of ethical, social, and political controversy. Read about a plan to eliminate all political parties. Entertain the possibility of an overhaul of the patent system and its replacement with a system that rewards inventors while eliminating monopolistic control of patents and technological suppression. Many other transformative ideas are discussed in the book, including issues related to the monetary system, real estate, scientific paradigms, and a rational approach to conspiracy theory. While Ethical Empowerment will challenge your mind to consider new perspectives, the ethical challenge is always to keep the diversity, depth, and breadth of perspective within the boundaries of love. Ethical Empowerment is available at Amazon.com and most online booksellers in both print and ebook editions.